You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In 1999, Colin Saunders and his family had a very close encounter with a triangular craft not of this world. That encounter set Colin on a quest to discover as much as he could about these enigmatic flying triangles over the UK. In his new book, Triangular UFOs of the United Kingdom, Colin recounts his own personal encounter, his experiences since that day, and includes over 130 other encounters from around the UK from witnesses who have contacted him to discuss their own personal sightings. Before we join Colin, though, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is on all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, merchandise, and news. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Now, let's head back to March 1999 and hear from Colin about an evening that changed his life forever. A journey home after a birthday celebration in 1999 saw Colin Saunders' life changed instantly. Whilst travelling on the historic Foss Way, a triangular object appeared and Colin began a quest for answers and uncovered reports from around the world. In his new book, Colin has collected numerous encounters from around the UK and beyond, and I am delighted to welcome Colin to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
Hello, Paul. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. I'm very well indeed. And thank you for joining me, Colin. This is a subject that I've had a real interest in since I became aware of what's now become known as the Belgian flap at the tail end of the 80s and early 90s. So I've always had a real interest in reports about triangular objects and incidents and encounters outside of the usual cliched discs or cigar shaped ones. Now, I don't mean that disrespectfully. I just think it's really nice that we have a collection such as you've pulled together here with numerous reports covering this. And one of the aspects of all this that really interests me in regards to you and your sighting and your collating of the evidence and what you've tried to do is essentially you are someone who should really know what they look about in the sky due to how your career has gone as a person and the amount of work you've done in the aerospace industry over your career.
Yeah, thank you for that, Paul. That's a nice introduction. Yes, I think it's important, actually, before we get into the actual sighting, that we do talk briefly on my career. The reason being that I've spent all of my life, I'm 65 now, I spent all of my career as a draftsman. I've always been into drawing. I've been a technical draftsman and I specialised in electronics. So I was an electrical design draftsman. I worked in various jobs around the world in many different countries. But importantly, I did work for the Airbus. I worked for Messerschmitt MBB and Messerschmitt Bolko Blohm in Hamburg. Mm. Worked on the Airbus. It was quite some time ago, so it was the early Airbus, the A300 and the A310, a little bit on the A320. But I spent a year there in Hamburg. I was only 21 at the time, quite young for contracting.
Yeah.
And gained some invaluable experience and had a jolly old time while I was there. Hamburg was a lovely place and Germans were lovely people.
Yeah, it's brilliant, Hamburg. It's a wonderful city.
From there, I did go to New Zealand for 18 months, but I was involved with refrigeration. There's a lot of cool stores and carcass freezers in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So I spent quite some time over there. that's interesting because all the long haul flights that you do between New Zealand and England, obviously. Back in the UK, my next sort of position was working for Chevron Petroleum. I've always worked contract, so I get paid by the hour, and you get to go on a year's contract at different places once you get onto the circuit. So it wasn't unusual to go from aircraft to the oil industry, for instance, because you still knew about electronics and still know how to draw schematic diagrams, etc.
Yeah.
So I spent a year in Aberdeen. I was based on shore, but importantly, I did have a couple of offshore trips to the platform. Now, we had I worked for Chevron, so we had the Ninian field. We had three platforms, central, northern and southern. So when you go offshore, it was drilled into you. You had to make sure you got the work done correctly, because it's quite a thing to get on the helicopters, get out there. You need your accommodation booked, etc. You're out there for a week. You've got to make sure it's absolutely 100% perfect. So when you get back to the office, you can draw it all up, because you can't just hop on the next helicopter out and have another look at something that you've missed. So it's good training in that respect, which came invaluable once we had the sighting. After a year in Aberdeen, my next contract was in the aircraft industry again. This time I went to Sweden and I worked for Saab Aerospace in a town called Linköping, where I worked on a civilian aircraft, a 34-seater, the SF-340, as it was called. I spent 2 years there, 1 year working in the cockpit, and the second year I was working on the engines and the wings and the horizontal and vertical stabilisers, all to do with the cabling and lighting systems, etc. I came back from Sweden for the birth of my daughter, Victoria, and then I became a design office manager at Courtauld's in Coventry, one of their subsidiaries called Amteco, who manufactured floors. But then, unfortunately, I caught chickenpox off my daughter. We both had it at the same time, and it made me really ill to the point where post-viral fatigue syndrome, or ME, as it was called in them days.
Yeah.
And I lost my job after 12 months of trying to recover from it. It really did knock me about. In a way, that was a bit of a godsend, because I set my own business up eventually. And I got involved with embroidery design, digitization. So I was still drafting, but doing sort of like CAM work.
Yeah.
So I was working from home and building the business up, and I had three people working for me at the time, two designers and a girl who was doing sampling on one of the embroidery machines. But we're still working from home, and this was at the point when we had the experience with the triangle. And the next day, over the next few weeks, I found it very difficult to concentrate on work. I really needed to be concentrating on the UFO. So I was in a position where the staff were running the business and I was from home, and I was starting to make models, etc. So that's a brief history of my working career. Now, obviously, it's important. I've worked in the aircraft industry. I know what aircraft look like. I've been to quite a few aircraft shows over the years, both in Germany and in the UK. And obviously, I've always been a draftsman as well, so I know about geometry. So it's all actually quite a career that was pointing me in the right direction for having this encounter.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I had to smile, because growing up, I've got a couple of friends who've worked in similar fields as yourself, Colin, usually in design. So when I see the term AutoCAD, I smile, because it takes me back to a conversation I was part of at the end of the 90s, I think, where I got two friends who were talking about AutoCAD. And essentially, I felt like I was surrounded by people speaking Latin. I had no idea what they were talking about at all. So it's something that I've been fully aware of for a long time in regards to the design and construction of planning and things like that, as you say.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because I forgot to mention myself that I did become AutoCAD User of the Year.
Yes.
Back in 1992.
Yeah.
I got a trophy for that. I was awarded some bits of equipment as well at the NEC, so that was quite an accolade.
Fantastic.
That was for work that I did at Courtauld's with automatic bill of materials for design floors that we were producing. It was quite interesting stuff, if you like numbers and figures and geometry.
I really
enjoyed that. But yeah, that did show that I had quite a vast experience of CAD and CAD-CAM.
Yeah.
Especially AutoCAD and one or two other systems as well. Computer Vision Medusa was another one that I used to use at one time. Yeah. Became very familiar with. So yeah, very comfortable around drafting and computer-aided design.
So, I mean, for some people, what I'm always interested in, Colin, is when I speak to people in a variety of topics who have ended up having an experience that they didn't really have much interest in until it happened to them. Now, obviously, I don't think many people can not know about the subject, but I think when you talk about UFOs or strange things in the sky, people will be aware of it without really following up or having a real interest. And this, from what I gather and reading in your book, Colin, was yourself. You were aware of it, you knew about science fiction, and yet this encounter occurred to you in 1999 that just turned your world on its head.
That's right. I've never been involved with the UFO world. I've never been deeply interested in the subject, but the same as everybody else. You know, as a child, you sort of read the von Daniken book, Chariot of the Gods. That was a big thing at the time. But basically, no, I wasn't looking for any UFOs. I wasn't in any UFO groups. That's an interesting thing, though, isn't it? Because, you know, along the years, I've met a lot of people who are fanatical about UFOs, and they go out on night watches looking for UFOs, and they never ever get to see anything. But they're really keen to do it. I'm impressed with their tenacity.
Yeah.
It's almost like if you're looking for it, it's not going to happen. It just seems to happen out of the blue, as it were. But yeah, it's certainly true to say before the encounter, I had no particular interest in UFOs at all. And if anybody had asked me about UFOs, I would have said that they were flying saucers that had come from another planet.
Yep.
But that was all about to be blown apart on the 31st of March, 1999.
Yeah. I had to chuckle, Colin, when I've read your book and heard you speak about this before, that you, after the event, obviously we'll dive into what happened, but as you mentioned there, the date. So I would imagine it was quite pertinent to think of that when you start to tell people, it was April the 1st. And I would imagine that some people just thought you were pulling their legs.
You would have thought so, actually. But I don't know what it is about me, but everybody seems to take it on board. Nobody thought I was playing an April Fool's joke.
Oh.
Maybe that was because everybody knew there was four of us who were there who saw it. And we were all saying the same thing. We weren't all playing the same practical joke on people. But yeah, it did make me wonder whether the aliens had got a sense of humour by doing that on the 31st of March, just a couple of hours before April Fool's Day. But yeah, I have been extremely encouraged by people's reaction to my story along the way. There's not been many people who have gone against it. Not many people have poo-pooed the idea. Most people, in fact, some people have actually said, well, because it's you, we believe you. We believe you've seen something.
Yeah.
But I understand you need to see it yourself to really understand what's going on and to believe. I remember in the early days, a guy in Belgium, there was a bit of a Belgium connection with the triangle, but a guy in Belgium got in touch with me who had been building models. He'd seen my model in a UFO magazine that used to be run by Graham Birdsall.
Yeah.
And he basically said to me in one of his letters that there are two types of people in this world, one who's had an encounter and those who haven't. Now, at the time, I thought that was a bit arrogant from him. But over the years, you sort of like tend to think, yeah, he was probably spot on saying that, because once you've had an experience, your mind opens up and you take on board a lot of other people's experiences. And I think people who haven't perhaps had such a close encounter, a lot of them are very quick to knock the idea and say, well, it's a TR3B. You get that a lot, you know, from people.
Yeah. Yes. But
I do understand you do need to see this yourself to really cross over that fence, if you like.
Mm, absolutely. So your experience, Colin, came at the end of a what had been a very lovely night out.
Yes, it was my mother-in-law's birthday. She was 72 that day. Now, I didn't know prior to the event, I didn't know until last year, actually, that she'd obviously had some involvement with the paranormal world. She died, unfortunately, during COVID, not of COVID, but when they cleared out her bedroom, she got all these paper cuttings in the bottom of her cupboard, all about paranormal stuff that she'd collected over the years. I've got all those here. I will read them all one day when I get time, probably when I retire.
Yeah.
But it was her birthday, Maggie's birthday. She was 72. So we decided to go out to a pub called the White Lion at Paleton, which is in Warwickshire, in the middle of nowhere, really, a tiny little village. So my wife was driving. We went and picked the mother-in-law up. And in our car, there was myself and my daughter. It's three generations, my mother-in-law, my wife and my daughter and myself.
Mm.
We had a second vehicle, a Range Rover. Now, my brother-in-law was driving the Range Rover. He's got a French partner, and her grandparents were over for the week to visit. So they were coming out with us as well. So the eight of us set off and went to the White Lion, had a bar meal, and then come to leave. Nothing exciting happened during the evening, just a pleasant evening out. When we come to leave, I remember we got into the car. Now, my wife was driving, and it was a two-door Ford Fiesta. And I was sitting in the back with my daughter, and my mother-in-law was sitting in the front in the passenger seat. And as we were pulling off the car park, I looked out the back window, and I could see my brother-in-law helping the old French lady into the Range Rover, which she was struggling a bit because she was old, and Range Rovers are quite high up, quite a high step to get in. So we pulled off, and I thought they'd be catching us up shortly on the way because it's not that far to go home. We were living in Hinckley at the time.
Yeah.
So we left Paleton and drove through the little country lanes, and we were heading towards the Foss Way. Now, the Foss Way is an old Roman road which leads up to the Watling Street, which is another Roman road, and they join at a place called High Cross, which is just outside of Hinckley.
Mm.
That's for anybody who's interested in Roman roads, because they're supposed to have been built on ley lines. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I don't know if there's any connection there. But the junction of the Foss and the Watling Street was only about 4 miles from where we was going to have the sighting. So we'd driven through the lanes, yeah, and we came up to the Foss Way, and somebody said, oh, here's the Foss Way. And my daughter jokingly said, oh, there's been talk of headless horsemen down here. Then we all laughed and said, oh, we'll keep our eyes open then. And we turned the corner, and there in front of us, exactly half a mile away, hovering by the side of the road, were these lights. They were mainly red lights with a bit of white mingled in. And they were the brightest lights you've ever seen. They were just incredible, like LEDs, like a firework display. And we were going, wow, what on earth is that light? It's too low to be an helicopter or airplane, too many lights for a helicopter. And we drove towards them, like, all excited. So we drove the half mile distance, and we came up to the lights, and there were just lights. There was no craft, there were just lights. Now, I would say they would be 100 feet away from us. Now, bear in mind, I've been a draftsman all my life, and I've also steered my friend's narrow boat around the Ashby Canal, which is 70 foot long.
Mm.
So when I say 100 feet, I mean 100 feet. I've got to hit it with a cricket ball. But as we stopped and looked at it, and I would say it would only be maybe 50 feet off the ground. At the rear, there were four big red lights, and they were in a row, but there was at an angle to the earth. They weren't parallel to the earth. They were like tilted up at 30 degrees.
Mm.
And then there was another little red light off to one side that I could see, which was underneath the four big red lights, but a lot smaller. And then there was some white light mingled in as well. So the whole thing was extremely confusing as to what was there. And we were just staring at these lights, and I'm thinking, you know, what on earth are they? And I stared at one of the lights, the big red lights at the back, four red lights. I stared at one of those, and it got like a crisscross effect on the surface, but it looked like that was an effect from the light source, like Newton's law of ring interference. It wasn't like a pattern etched onto glass. You could see the red light sort of vibrating and producing a pattern within it, like a crisscross effect. And it's when I was staring at that and wondering about that, that I noticed the sky is starting to ripple around the lights. And that was the first time I thought, my word, there's something there. There's something else. It's not just lights. There's something around the lights. And then as soon as I thought that, it decloaked. Now, it decloaked just like on Star Trek, you know, when the Klingon ship just peels off its cloak and there it is. Well, yeah. That's what happened. It peeled off its cloak and became a solid metallic object. And then the rear end stayed where it was, and the nose floated up in the air like a stallion rearing, like a horse rearing up.
Yeah.
But it floated up like a submarine underwater. It didn't move like a Harrier jump jet. It floated. It was amazing to see the way it sort of glided up, just like it was like a submarine or something underwater.
Mm.
It was that close to the ground that the rear end stayed where it was. That was the pivot point, and the nose rose up in the air. If it had tilted from the middle, it would have struck the ground. It was that close. And as the nose rose up in front of us, it just filled the field of vision. And it was the top surface of the craft. I didn't realise that there's very few people in the world who've ever seen the top surface of these craft. Everybody sees the bottom when they're flying overhead.
Yeah.
There's very few people get to see the top. And it looked like it was alive. It was incredible. It looked like it was organic, but you could clearly see it had been manufactured. You could see the surface was like liquid mercury running up and down the surface in little waves. And on top of that were these silver beams, like girders that were interlocking on the surface, which formed a pattern like a maze in an old-fashioned garden. It was just like stunning. And as it rose up and I watched it fill the vision in front of us, I thought to myself, my God, aliens exist. Abductions take place, and this explains mysteries from history. Three thoughts came straight into my mind just all at the same time like that. And my wife, unfortunately, is a very sensible person, and she was driving. So the car was stopped at this point when the triangle materialized, but she was concentrating more on the road in case there was any other traffic around, because it's a clear way. There's no stopping on the Foss Way. Although at the time there was no traffic whatsoever, but she decided then, because there was a gateway just where we'd stopped, so she decided to pull forward and reverse into the gateway. So she put her hazard flashes on and pulled forward. And the problem with that is when she pulled forward, there was a large hedge that blocked the view of the craft. And I couldn't see the craft anymore. And I thought to myself, oh no, if it's going to go, it's going to go now. So she reversed into the gateway. We jumped out of the car. Sure enough, it had gone. We would have been right underneath it by the time we reversed into the gateway if it had still been there. But in the distance, there was a huge craft going away, the size of a football pitch, and it got four red lights on the back of it, the same as the small craft we'd seen by the side of the road. Mm-hmm. And I was saying to the girls, look, there it is. It's changed size. It's massive. And they're going, oh, I don't know. That looks like a normal airplane. I said, it's not. Look at the four red lights on the back. It's the same as what we just seen down here, but a lot bigger. And then we were standing there, and it was so quiet, you could hear a pin drop. You know, they call it the Oz effect.
Yes.
And then traffic started up again, and airplanes and that. And we checked to watch. It was 9:50, but we don't know what time we left the pub. So we got no reference point. We got back in the car, drove home. Now, my brother-in-law lived next door to my mother-in-law. He bought the house next door to his mum. When we arrived back, we were surprised to see the Range Rover was already there, plus all the occupants were out and they were actually inside the house having a cup of tea. We thought that was a bit strange how that had happened. So that was the general story. Now, that's what I would call the nuts and bolts of the encounter. Now, at the time, there was something else that took place, and we'll come back to that in a bit, because for the first 20 years, I just stuck to the nuts and bolts of what we'd seen that night. I didn't want to get too far down the road of the strange,
yep,
strangeness of the encounter. So we got home, and the first thing we did was the same as I would do coming back from offshore, is to do some drawings while it's still fresh in the mind. I got my daughter to draw it as well. Now, my wife, unfortunately, only ever seen the light. She'd never seen the craft materialise. It was just me, my mother-in-law, and my daughter who saw the craft. So then from there, I sort of progressed into doing some proper drawings the next day on Coral Draw, making it look really perfect with the liquid surface, etc.
Mm-hmm.
The beams on top, printed those out. I was so excited. I phoned a friend of mine the next day who'd, on the grapevine, we'd heard he'd seen a UFO at some point, but nobody really believed him.
Yeah.
So he was the first guy I phoned. And I said, hey, Reese, you never guess what I seen last night. He says, a UFO. I says, how do you know that? And then he says, was it triangular? And I nearly fainted. I thought, how does he know that? Is he psychic? Because surely most people think they're circular.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, he says, mine was triangular. So I knew straight away then he was telling me the truth, that he had seen a UFO. He'd seen a triangle. He wouldn't make it up. You wouldn't say he'd seen a triangle if you're trying to make a story up about UFOs. Certainly not 20 years ago, 24 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me the phone number of the UFO magazine, and I phoned and chatted with Graham Birdsall.
Yep.
And we became friends over the years with Russell Callahan. He gave me the phone number of Omar Fowler.
Yes.
So I got in touch with Omar and I told him the story about what had happened. He came over and interviewed us. And he also gave me some magazines to look at on the triangular craft. And as well as looking through one of these magazines, I couldn't believe what I'd seen. There was a guy in Belgium, I think it was in 1992, not the flap that everybody talks about. I think it was a different occasion. Yeah. But he had a UFO, a triangle, come over his head, and he sketched the underneath of it. And there's these beams interlocking, coming out of the surface in relief, the same as we'd seen on the top of our craft. Mm. We never got to see the bottom of the craft at all. We only seen the rear and the top surface. So when I seen this picture with these same beams interlocking, I thought, that's got to be either the same craft or the same series of craft. So I decided to use the Belgium sighting to produce the bottom of my craft and use my own sighting in the top and the rear to produce the rest of the model. So from there, I started to build initially some paper models, which I took to one of Omar's meetings in Derby and handed those out so everybody could have a look at them. But then I decided to build a wooden model. So I got some doweling and some bits of plywood and printed off the pictures of the triangle again and pasted them onto the wooden frame that I'd made. And this was a bit like, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Guy, where he gets like obsessed with building models.
I've got
the staff running the business in the house, and I was in the shed like with my filing all the noses on the triangle to make them perfectly round. That was an important thing I seemed to have to do.
Yeah.
And it was great actually to be able to have the time to do that. So I made my first model. I had a van that I used for work. We were starting to sell a few T-shirts. Although we started the business to do the design work, which was going really well, we were also, as a sideline, selling shirts to clubs and pubs and societies and things. So I bought myself a little van for delivering. Now, the van was broken into one night on the driveway. And when I took it to my friend to have the door repaired where they'd broken in, he said it had been professionally broken into, the way they removed the lock. And he was amazed that somebody would do that on such an old van. And all they stole was an old cassette player with a graphic equalizer in it. But in them days, everybody was into CDs. You know, it was just an old thing. It wasn't worth anything. It didn't even work proper, although you wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
But that was stolen from the van. But then I come to look for my model, and I remember the last time I seen it, it was in the van down by the passenger seat. And, you know, I searched that van top to bottom, and it wasn't there. And that model never, ever turned up. Whoever stole the cassette player also took the model. And whether they knew what it was or not, whether they came for that, I have no idea. But it seemed a bit of a coincidence that it was professionally broken into and the model had disappeared. So that set me on a mission to make the next model. So did the same again, slightly bigger. But this time I went to Maplin's in Leicester, and I brought some flashing LED lights and a battery pack. And so I made my next model, which was slightly better than the first one, but certainly with the lights in it. I put 3 red lights in the bottom and 4 red lights at the back, and I put a switch on it. I've still got that model today, and it still works really well. It's quite amazing. And what happened there, like, I was looking at the model. So I remember on the night when the craft materialised, I could first see like a diamond shape in the sky from the rear end, and there was a little red light off to one side underneath the 4 big red lights. But for some reason, when I seen the craft rise up in the air, I knew it was triangular. So when I built the model, I instinctively did the bottom of the model flat. I didn't make a diamond shape at the rear. So I'm sitting playing with the model one night, just looking at it in the chair at home, and I've got it in front of me looking at the rear end, and I tilt the nose down slightly. What happens then is you get the silhouette of a diamond because the nose comes into view.
Yeah.
And the bottom of the craft. And also, the little red light underneath at the front of the craft comes into view as well. And that would have been the spurious red light I saw off to one side on the night of the encounter.
Yeah.
Because it was different to the 4 big red lights at the back. They would have got like the crisscross effect on them. But the little red one underneath was more like a ball of plasma. But it was also surrounded with mist. And I remember as the craft materialized, on the bottom 2 wingtips closest to me, little fluffy white clouds appeared on the corners. And they're quite beautiful to look at, the clouds. Amazing little pure white fluffy condensation, proper little clouds on the corners. I've got a theory on that, which I'll come to later. But yeah, so playing with the model, I learned that what we saw that night was a brief glimpse of the underneath of the craft. And the little red light on the front was, in fact, on the nose of the craft. And because there was mist on the rear 2 corners of the triangle, one assumes there would be mist on the 3rd corner as well. A bit like a heat sink, you know, where the heat goes to the points of least resistance.
Yeah.
So when I was looking at the craft and I could see the 4 big red lights and the little red light off to one side underneath that was covered in what looked like smoke or mist, that probably would have been condensation, the same as the rear 2 wingtips. So as the craft materialized, as it decloaked, it produced this vaporization on the corners. And like I say, I've got a theory on that, which I'll come back to later. But once I built the craft, that was great. And with Omar Fowler, we managed to get onto TV. We went onto Central Weekend Live, spoke to 3 million people, which was good. It's quite exciting, quite scary to say the least.
Yeah.
But the only problem with the craft, as far as I was concerned, the model, the beams on the surface were not raised up off the surface. They were just flat. And there was no way I could sort of print a 3D image of the surface. But a friend of mine who I've been chatting to over the years, John Mills, he's a doctor of physics. He's got his own business. And he came to me one day and he goes, I put myself a 3D printer and I'd like to print your UFO for you. I thought, that's great. Like, so he printed a little handheld A5 size 3D printed model with beams raised up off the surface, the red lights in the back, white light in the middle and three red lights in the corner. And it was brilliant. Like, and I couldn't believe it, done it. And it was fantastic. But it wasn't quite still 100% because of the colours. It was just all in black. So I said to John, because I know he'd spent some time on it and it cost a little bit of money to produce, I said, is there any chance you can make me a big one with like the liquid effect on the surface and silver beams interlocking? And what we agreed was, because he'd spent some time making the little ones, and I thought that was really good of him to do that for me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, like, now you've got all the files, you can just print them off. I can start selling them on eBay. And if I sell enough, we make me a big one.
Yeah.
And he agreed. So I steered him to a website that's in the book, UFO Explorer in Canada. There's a guy there, Abel DeLego. He did some great CGI images, some great graphics of my craft for me, free of charge, and put them on his website. They look fantastic.
Mm.
They appear in the book. So I pointed John in the direction of the website so he could see what I was talking about, the liquid effect and the beams. He also took a fancy to a flying saucer and a cigar that he's seen on the same website. So he printed those as well. So I ended up selling flying saucer and cigars and triangles. Now, I didn't make any money out of it myself. In fact, it probably cost me a pound or two by the time I'd done the postage and packaging and paid commission to eBay.
Yeah.
All the profit went to John. And eventually, he made me a large model. So I'm looking at that at the moment. It's fantastic. It's A4 size. The surface is all ridged like liquid. It looks like it's got liquid running up and down the surface. Then on top of that, we've got silver interlocking beams. We've got the red lights on the back. He's even got a crisscross effect onto the lights. And then underneath, we've got the central white light, three red lights in the corner and beams interlocking again. And the bottom is obviously, like I said earlier, based on the Belgium sighting. So once I got that large model, I decided I'd go and do a conference. I hadn't been to a conference to speak for a long time.
Yeah.
So I went to the Outer Limits magazine conference, OLM, in the hall.
Yes.
Last year. And did a presentation there. The presentation went really well. The main reason being that I did a presentation. I got my, I've forgotten what it's called now, Excel, is it? I got my presentation together, basically.
Yeah.
And I was rehearsing it, and COVID came.
Mm.
So it kept getting cancelled year after year. So it must have been 3 years, maybe 4 years, I'd been practicing.
Yes.
Like all that time.
Yeah.
So when it actually came to do the presentation, I knew it all off by heart, and it did go really well. And I think people were quite interested. Well, they were very interested in what I had to say. And I think having the model makes everything far more tangible. People can see what you're talking about. You can talk to your blue in your face, but if you've got a model and you can show people, it really does make it easier to understand what's going on. So at the conference, I was chatting to a few people, and I got chatting to somebody, you know, Philip Kinsella.
Yes.
Philip and Ronnie. I was chatting to both of those. Ronnie was telling me about his own experience with a triangle that he'd seen.
Mm-hmm.
And Philip was really encouraging. He enjoyed my presentation, and he suggested that I write a book. And I said, well, you know, I don't know. I'd like to write a book, but I don't know if I've got enough information. He said, well, just think of it as an extension of the presentation that you've done today. That sort of got me thinking. And I had thought along the way that I would like to write a book about my experience, my family. But I hadn't planned to do it until I retired. But I thought, well, let's have a go at it now. I don't know why, but Philip gave me that impetus to get on and do it.
Yeah.
So I came back and I started getting it all together. So basically the first part was a bit like my presentation. It talked about the family encounter. It talked about the career, the technical work, and some of the local witnesses as well were from the local newspapers that I'd collected. By the time I'd done all of that, though, I'd only got to about 10,000 words, and I needed something like 70,000 words to get a proper book.
Mm.
And we've got over 400 pages. So what I decided to do then was start pulling all the other sightings that people had sent to me over the years. I had to go back through all my emails and back through Messenger and contact people again. Because one of the things is, once you've had an experience and you put yourself out there, people are keen to talk to you, because it's a, you find yourself doing a bit of counselling without realising it, because people just want to talk to somebody who's had the same experience.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were contacting me. In fact, we've ended up with over 130 different encounters in the book, and they're all triangles, and they're all from the UK, which is primarily what I wanted to write the book about.
Yeah.
I mean, if I started talking about triangles in America, we'd have volumes and volumes and volumes of books.
Yeah.
Like War and Peace.
I mean, when you first came out, because when you read the book, it's interesting that you were very assured in regards to your experience. And I think, as we were saying in the introduction, Colin, because of your experience in design and the fact that you'd worked in the aerospace industry, you were very confident in your ability to recall and create what you'd seen and experienced. When you went to the local press, I suppose it's a double-edged sword, that you were very assured in regards to your personal experience. And I would imagine that often for many people who have had an experience of strange things, I mean, I've seen a strange thing in the sky that I still to this day cannot explain, but mine was more like a ball of fire, Colin.
Uh-huh.
And when I told people, most people either thought I was making it up or I'd just not understood what I was seeing. But I was fully aware of what it is, and it's still burned into my brain, pardon the pun, in regards to what happened and when it happened and how long I watched it for. So for you, when you came forward to the local press, were you surprised, pleased, intrigued that people began to reach out and speak to you? Because as you say, I think one of the things that people don't comprehend sometimes or overlook when you come forward and you speak about these things is that, as you say, you end up in a way counselling other people, because for them, you might be the first person they've met or read about or heard who's seen something that they've seen, and therefore they know whatever they tell you, you're going to take them seriously.
That's right. And I've had quite a few local people say to me that it's been great to be able to chat to me about it, because there's nobody really else they can reach out to talk about it. But what happened locally in the Hinckley Times, there was an article by somebody else about a triangular UFO that had been sighted. So that set me off. I wrote to the Hinckley Times and told them about my own sighting, and they were keen to do a feature on it. And we did a double page spread about our own encounter. And from there, people started to contact me, local people who'd had contact with triangles. And there must have been about a dozen people. The strange thing is, overall, that they were all triangles. I know I'd put my sighting in as a triangle, but I did say to people, you've had any experience and you want to talk about it, you know, get in touch.
Yeah.
All the people locally were seeing triangles. They're all different size and shapes, and at different times as well. And yes, one or two of them were saying to me, it's great to be able to find somebody who takes it seriously. I mean, some of them have kept it bottled up for years, and they just hadn't talked about it until they'd seen my article in the Hinckley Times. Now, I had one girl. It's a shame now. She has come to me since and said that she would have been okay with me putting her name in the book.
Mm.
And originally, when I asked her, I didn't get a reply from her for, well, it must have been a couple of months.
Yeah.
So rather than risk putting a real name in and talking about what you'd seen, I used a pseudonym, but I also changed her from a she to a he.
Yes.
And it's in the book now. It's a shame, because she has come to me since then and said, oh, it'd be okay for me to use a name, a proper name and all that, but it's too late now. It's been printed. But basically, that's adjoining Hinckley is a place called Burbage. It's all one conurbation, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And Frances, she'd been working at, I think it's like a Witherspoon's in the town. And she left there late at night, about 1 o'clock. She finished her shift, went home, and she was in the garden in Burbage, which is a very populated area, having a cigarette in the back garden. And she's seen some lights coming across towards her. across the town. And she said they looked like the orange lights at the beginning, but as they got closer, they seemed to change into red lights. And she thought it was a helicopter. She didn't think too much of it for a start, but they got closer and closer. So she then took her earphones out because she was listening to music, expecting to hear a helicopter, but she said there was no noise. And then she said it came right down into the bottom of a garden, and it tilted up, and it was a triangular-shaped UFO. And as it tilted up, there was a glass dome underneath, and she saw two beings in the glass dome looking at her. And she panicked and thought she was going to get abducted, and she ran in the house, screaming to get out of the way. And I met her in Costa Co or something in town. You know, I had a coffee and chatted to her about it, and I'm thinking, this is absolutely amazing, you know. People are having these experiences right in the centre of town, and nobody else hears about it or gets to see about it. It was just absolutely fantastic. But I think she enjoyed being able to talk to somebody about the experience she had. I did say to her as well, you know, has your dad had any experiences? Because these things tend to run in families. And she says, oh, no, no. But then she sent me an email a while later saying, oh, you know, when I got back, I asked my dad if he'd had any experiences with UFOs. And he had. He'd seen stuff in the past. She says, I wish he'd told me earlier because I thought he thought I was nuts. Oh. So that was just one of the sightings. Also, like locally, in the town centre, we've got a place just on the outskirts of the town centre called Transco, which is the gas central distribution unit. It's got a big antenna out the back, massive, like lots of different antennas on top of the pylons, where they control all the gas around the country, the flow of the gas and all that. Quite an important building. And I think it's on three separate occasions, triangles have been seen over this building and over the antenna array by different people on three separate occasions. And you have to ask yourself, what are they interested in? But one of the interesting ones, it's in the book, a guy called Keith, who lives in Hinckley. He had a girlfriend in Nuneaton at the time. This is back in the late 70s. And he had a motorbike. He left Nuneaton, I think it was something like 12 o'clock at night. Mm. He came up Coventry Road in Hinckley towards Transco. And the weird thing is, he says, like, as he was driving along, these little balls of light started flying with him. That was like a red one, I think, and a blue one, which is weird enough in itself. But
yeah.
He said, and then as he got to Transco, his motorbike stopped. Mm. The engine just packed up. And he said he sat there with his legs straddled the motorbike, and he looked up, and this triangle came over Transco, over the gas corporation, and he said it was massive. Initially, he said it was the size of a football pitch, and then corrected himself and said, no, it was probably 1 1/3 or 1 1/2 times the size of a football pitch. And he said it's silent, and it came overhead, and underneath, about a third of the way down, there was a glass dome, but he couldn't see anybody inside the glass dome. It just looked like it was some sort of observation area. He said this thing just silently glided overhead and off towards the town centre at midnight. And once it had gone out of view, he kicked his motorbike up. It started up okay. So he went home, and it was 1:30, and it should have been 12:10. So he woke his parents up and said, look, you know, I've just had this UFO come over me. You stopped me bike, and I've lost 1.5 hours. They confirmed the time was right. It was 1:30, and it should have been like 12. And I've seen him a few times, you know, and to this day, he says he doesn't know what happened to that 1.5 hours. It just disappeared. And, yeah, his sighting's in the book. That was quite an interesting experience for him.
Yeah. I mean, when you look back at what happened to you and your family at that time, Colin, it's not strange. It's one of those things, I think, once again, it's these little things that sometimes get overlooked in people's experiences, especially when there's more than one witness, because there were four of you in the car, as you say, three generations. You were in the back with your daughter. So your wife didn't really see it that well. She saw the lights, but I've been surprised to hear that when I've heard you speak about this or read, you and your mother-in-law were sort of excited, interested. Your daughter seemed quite frightened as a young child maybe in these circumstances, and your wife seemed very matter-of-fact about it. And I think it gets overlooked sometimes how it emotionally affects people in such a different way.
Yes, yeah. I mean, on the night, It's true to say that me and my mother-in-law, we would have got on board. We were so excited. We wanted to get out and go and get closer to it.
Yes.
But partly maybe she's done that because she's had other experiences that she's never talked about, because I've got all those newspaper cuttings. I know after the event, anything that happened, like any UFO reports in any of the local papers or the daily newspapers, she'd cut them out and send them up to me. Like, she was collecting them, like, so we were sharing some UFO stuff. So she was very interested in it. Myself, yeah, I was just so excited because I've never seen anything like it before in my life. And I knew straight away what it was or what it wasn't.
Yes.
My daughter, being 12 years old, probably hadn't had quite so much experience of aviation and that, but she obviously knew that something weird was taking place. And my wife was very much matter of fact, which surprised me really, because when we were youngsters, she was the one who had the von Daniken book that everybody used to borrow. She was into this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, before we run out of time, I want to go back to that night and why I think it had such a strange effect on me. It's becoming more mainstream now, but when I started talking about this 20 years ago, I only ever talked about the nuts and bolts of the encounter. And that's what we've talked about so far today, is the nuts and bolts of what we saw that night. But something else took place, and it only seemed to happen to me. And I wouldn't talk about it in the past because I thought I would be ridiculed, and even now it sounds crazy. However, more and more people are saying this, so I'm feeling a lot more comfortable about it now. And it's not that major, but basically what happened when the craft tilted up in front of us, when it materialized and floated up in front of us, my first thoughts were, my God, aliens exist. Abductions take place. So this explains mysteries from history. Right at that point, the best way to describe it was like somebody got a pair of binoculars and put them in front of my eyes. Because all of a sudden, I could see the detail on the surface really close. I could see the lines interlocking.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one view. Then the next view was the nose, the big round nose at the front. I could see it that big that I couldn't see any of the beams on the surface anymore. It was like it was right in front of me, like just 3 or 4 feet away, because it felt like I got these binoculars in front of me. And then there was a side view. Now, the centre of the craft, around the outside, there's like a white central section, and the top and the bottom, the grey parts, are sort of bonded on top of the white central core, milky white core. And they roll over onto the core like a hovercraft skin, like a pie, edge of a pie. They roll over onto the central white core. Now, where they're joined, I remember thinking, wow, there's no welding, there's no nuts and bolts, there's no rivets. And there's no dirt, there's no muck, there's no burn marks, no nothing. The way it all, it just looked absolutely like it come out of a car showroom, but brand new, you know what I mean? And there was no, the way it had been put together, there were no seams. It was seamless, even though it was dissimilar metals joined together.
Yeah.
And then the next thing I think remember saying is, like, I want to get out, I want to get out, I want to get out of the car and have a look at it, get on board, like. And that's when my wife pulled forward and the view got blocked and it disappeared. So the next day, I'm thinking about this, and I'm talking to my wife and one of her friends about it. And I'm saying, like, I think I had an out-of-body experience. This is because I got these close views, like. And it's true to say, without the close views, I would not have been able to build such an accurate model. Because I wouldn't, from the position we was in the car, looking at the craft, there's no way we could have seen the central white core running around the craft. I could only see that from one of these close views, which I assumed was an out-of-body experience. And I tried to read books on out-of-body experiences, see if I could do it again, but I never did manage to do it.
Yeah.
But it was comforting. I started to think that you could live without your body, that your soul maybe does actually carry on when you die. It was quite nice. But it didn't last that long, because back in the day, I remember I talked about Graham Birdsall and Richard Russell Callahan. They put on some fantastic shows and conferences in Leeds, and I met some very interesting people there. I met Stanton Freeman, Dr. Roger Lear, Stephen Greer, met him unfortunately, and I also met more importantly the late Bud Hopkins.
Yes.
Now, I managed to get to speak with Bud Hopkins. He was talking to people, like, and there was a queue of people, and I got to Bob and I said, like, I told him about the encounter with the triangle, how close it was, and then I got an out-of-body experience and got close views of the craft. Mm. And he says to me, "Now," he said, that wasn't an out-of-body experience. That was images placed in your mind by the aliens on board the craft.
Yeah.
Like a telepathy. And before we got a chance to expand on it, this rude woman with a crystal butted in and says, Bob, look, I found this in the forest next to where there'd been a UFO sighting. Can you talk to me about it?" And that was the end of my 30 seconds with Bob. He couldn't expand on what we'd just been chatting about, unfortunately.
Mm.
So I went away and I thought, that don't make sense. Because this was sort of like in the early days, only like 2 or 3 years after the event.
Yeah.
And so I made a note of it. Now, what was happening after the UFO event, I started to have paranormal experiences. I mean, it sounds crazy, I know. But after the UFO event, things started to happen. I started to see other lights in the sky, other UFOs at distance. And then I was starting to have other paranormal experiences. And I had a really scary one when I was out fishing with an invisible creature of some sort that walked up to me.
Is that the one where you could you hear it?
Yes,
moving about near you.
That's right. To quickly touch on that one, yeah. So I was out fishing. I was in a competition. I was fishing on the River Soar at Rothley in Leicestershire.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a club match. There was only about 10 of us. And I was in a field on my own. Fantastic swim. I went down the bank. It was quite a steep, high bank. And I was standing in the river with my waders, with my bait apron on. Oh, it was fantastic. Having a great time. And then I heard these footsteps coming across the field. And I decided I'd climb up the riverbank and make myself known, because I've seen farm workers down there shooting, because it's very remote, you know, it's on the countryside.
Yeah.
So I climbed up the bank and there's nothing there, but the noise is continuing, these four footsteps, and it's really quite loud. And I'm thinking, what on earth's this? It must be a cat. So I took a spike out of my rod holder that I used for my umbrella and decided what to do. My game plan, really, because I thought, shall I swim out to the island? But then I know cats can swim if they want to.
Yeah.
I thought, if it is a cat, I'm going to go back down the bank and get it to jump on me and impale it on its own weight. That was my game plan. It's amazing how quick you try and think of an escape route when you're in a situation. So I'm standing there with this spike and I'm bricking it, and this thing's coming towards me. And I'm trying to see it and I can't see anything. And it walks right in front of me, like 6 foot in front of me from left to right. Totally invisible, nothing there at all. And as it went past, I tried to scare it out. I was shouting, clapping my hands. I got the spike and hit the grass, see if I could scare it out, but there was nothing there at all. And I stood there and I thought, you know, a big cat wouldn't make noise like that anyway. And I thought, that had to be one of these, whatever they call a space-time contingency, whatever it was, wasn't there. It was in, like, another dimension. And that were the day, Paul, that I realised that the UFO was interdimensional and not extraterrestrial. Because prior to the UFO encounter, I wasn't having any experiences whatsoever. But after the UFO experience, I was starting to have all these paranormal experiences. And I wrote them all down in the dates that they occurred, and they're all in the book there. And so I believe the craft was dimensional. Now, what happened a bit later on, with one of the smaller models, I did a presentation in Birmingham to Dave Holdren's group over there.
Hmm.
And I told him about the close viewing, and Dave was saying that he had a report of a couple of guys who'd seen a UFO land, and they were standing at a gate watching it, and they watched the occupants get out, but they were quite a distance away, at the top of the hill somewhere. And then the guy said all of a sudden this alien's face was right in front of his face. It'd like telepathically come across the field at him.
Yeah.
And he was telling him in no uncertain terms he needed to leave and get away. He shouldn't be there. So I thought, well, that's a bit similar to what I'd experienced with the close viewing of the craft, but not quite the same sort of thing. But as coincidences go, within 2 weeks of that, I get an email out of the blue from a guy in America, and I've put his email into the book. He's never reported it to anybody, but he had an experience with a triangle. And he'd been searching the net looking for people who had triangular experiences, and he came across myself.
Mm-hmm.
With an interview I did with Richard Hall.
Yes.
Many years ago. Again, where I talked about the close viewing and the out-of-body experience. But this guy from America, the first thing he said was, just like you, I had 3 images placed in my mind when I had a close encounter with a triangle. So he goes on to say that this triangle came down to him And as he was staring at it, all of a sudden he could see it right up close. He could see the pipework around the outside of it. He could see some of the balls of light on the craft. And he thinks the third view was inside the craft itself. But he said they were images placed into his mind, just like the images that had been placed into my mind. Now, at that point, strangely enough, I've been listening to a lot of Dr. David Jacob's work.
Yes.
With all the abductees. And I like his work and I like what he has to say. And from all of the abductees that he's interviewed, it keeps coming across, and you hear it time and again, that telepathy takes place on board ships with aliens rather than talking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd always assumed that telepathy was like words. You'd have a conversation with words going backwards and forwards. But as Dr. David Jacobs was saying, that's not necessarily true. A lot of the abductees have images placed in the mind.
Yeah.
So when you think about it, they always say an image can paint 1,000 words. So would it not make more sense placing images in rather than talking about it? So it was like a eureka moment. All of a sudden, I thought, yeah, Bob was right. I've had images placed in my mind. It makes more sense now for a couple of reasons. One reason, it was only me who was having these extra experiences after the UFO event. My wife, my daughter and my mother-in-law were not having any other experiences. It was just all happening to me.
Mm.
So that I conclude from that, that the experiences I was having had come from the UFO, but also come from the fact that they had actually put images in my mind. Now, one of the other things I couldn't figure out from the out-of-body experience, if that's what it had been, was why when I was looking at the nose, for instance, and then the side view, I didn't see it roll. I didn't see the craft move from one side to another.
Mm.
It was like an instant image and then another instant image and then another instant images. So three instant images just like that, one after the other, without anything in between. That would make more sense for telepathy, I think, than for an out-of-body experience. So I then decided, although all of this we don't really know, we don't know the answers. I know it's a science we don't understand. But I decided that day that I'd had telepathy with an alien. And that was quite quite shocking. I'm quite unnerved by that, to be honest.
Do you think you were meant to see it, Colin?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it was waiting for us. It was absolutely waiting for us at the side of the road. Most people get to glimpse these things at distances. If you have a close encounter, it's there for you, not for anybody else. Nobody else saw it. My brother-in-law didn't see it in the Range Rover behind us. He should have done. And there might be another reason for that, which we can talk about as well. I think the scenery changed on the night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I asked my wife to draw what she saw. And obviously, she didn't see the craft, just the lights. But she drew three red lights in a perfect triangle. I mean, there's no way that we could have saw three red lights in a perfect triangle from the angle that we was looking at that craft. I mean, yeah. The craft wasn't there for a start initially, but there was a white light and there was four red lights at the rear, and they were all mingled up together. In fact, for my presentations, I got John, my friend who built the model for me, the 3D model, to print me a translucent model. And I used that in the dark to show the effect of all of the lights all mingled up together. But she drew three red lights in a perfect triangle. Now, a few months later, I asked her to draw again exactly what she saw. And again, she drew three red lights in an equilateral triangle. So if we take on board that the little one was waiting for us and it was all lit up like a Christmas tree, was that like an ambush? Was that the bait? Because as we were staring at that, looking at the trajectory of the large craft we seen afterwards, the mothership, there's a good possibility that was passing over the car at the same time that we were looking at the little one in the field.
Mm.
Therefore, my wife then seen the underneath of the large triangle, not the underneath of the small triangle at the side of the road. Now, I don't know if that's true. That's just extrapolation and conjecture. But it was. I certainly believe the craft was waiting for us. There was no way we were going to not see it. Also, it took me a long time to come up with a reason why it was tilted at 30 degrees to the Earth. It wasn't parallel with the Earth. It was tilted up. So as we looked at the rear of it, the four big red lights, the one on the left-hand side was highest up at 30 degrees to the one on the right-hand side. And the reason I think they did that was as we're driving towards it, they tilted the bottom of the craft towards us so that we got more view of the lights all mingled up rather than being flat onto us. Even though there was no craft there at the time, I think by tilting it up and tilting it slightly sideways, it just made all the lights so more visible. So I think that was done on purpose, and you know, it was intentional. When there is intent, there's purpose, there's a reason for it. And maybe it was because the big one was coming over the top of us. I don't know.
Yeah.
If anybody was asked, like, you know, what is the reason this has all happened to you, then why do you think it was done on purpose? It can only be to make the models and to write the book. So am I part of some sort of subtle disclosure without knowing it? Because this book is going to go out all over the world. Hopefully a lot of people will get to see it.
I mean, when you've had people come forward, because obviously this is the thing, and as you mentioned earlier, Colin, there's over 130 accounts in the book from all over. And whenever I see a collection like this, I'm always looking for sightings near to me. And as I mentioned, when I do another show, The Ghost Story Guys, we get all kinds of strange reports. And we got a black triangle one the other week, which was quite odd for me because I'm not certainly going to say I'm an expert on this, but one of the things that's always struck me about these particular encounters is that people always notice the silence. Even as you said earlier about the Oz effect, even the fact that the environment seems to go silent as this thing passes over them, or they see it. It's almost as if they're in some kind of vacuum, a bubble. And this report we got was near outside of Manchester, heading over towards the Peak District, so coming towards my neck of the woods, which is something that Jenny Randalls has done a lot of work on over the years in regards to the numerous amounts of sightings. And obviously you can go all the way up into the Pennines from the Peaks, and the same seems to occur there. The thing that struck me about this one that we received was that he pointed out how noisy it was, and yet nobody else seemed to realise what was happening. It was as if only he could hear the noise, because it was passing over an estate. So he said it was so loud, you would imagine it would bring people out into the street to look at the sky, Colin, because it was almost deafening. It was that loud. So when you've been dealing with this, is it, when you're getting these reports, are they all very similar in regards to this kind of silence effect, or do you get these subtle differences? As we were saying, that some people would think that they're meant to have this sighting, it's meant to happen to them, for whatever reason they're meant to see it.
Yes, there's a couple of points there. The noise. Now, we heard no noise whatsoever from our craft, but the engine on the car was still running. The engine didn't stop. There was no electrical interference. So we can't say there was no noise, but there was certainly no noise louder than the noise of the car engine. So one of the things I've done with the book, because there's 130 different sightings, is gone through and have a look at some of the similarities, try and pick out things that people are talking about, as you do with investigations and of this sort of anomaly. So for instance, on the sound side, there's nobody, I'm surprised you said that it was so loud, there's nobody talked about these things being loud at all. Not one. The descriptions basically are pretty much the same. It's like a dull hum, a low humming noise, like a transformer, like a, you know, electricity substation transformer, buzzing, droning. One person said it was sucking like a vacuum cleaner. Which was interesting, but by and large, there's either no noise or very little noise. But what little noise there is like a transformer. Getting back to the scenery business, what happened there was, like, the next day after the encounter, I went back obviously to the site and went through the same roads to go back through the same, exactly the same as we'd done the night before. Now, what amazed me was, once we turned onto the Foss Way from the country lane, this is in the daylight, there's no way we could have seen that craft being that low from turning the corner. There was just too much in the way, trees and hedges and stuff. Now, I don't think the craft was higher and came down as we drove towards it. It was like a clear view. There was nothing in the way from when we turned that corner to when we parked up next to it. And it was almost like the scenery had changed. Now, my wife, who was the not a skeptic, but she was very sensible and didn't see the craft. So she had a different experience altogether.
Mm.
Certainly not a life-changing experience for her. She knew the light shouldn't have been there, but she didn't see the craft and didn't have the same as the other three of us. She went to pick a friend of ours up, Ruby, from the airport from New Zealand. It was like a week or so afterwards. And came back that way to show her where we'd seen the lights on the Fossway. And when she got home, she said to me, you know, it's almost like the scenery was different. That was without me saying anything to her. She came out with that herself. She said, it's almost like the scenery was different on the night because I don't see how we could have seen it from turning the corner. So that was two of us coming up to the same conclusion.
So it's like you drove into its
situation. Yes, that's what it felt like, yes. But it's true to say that the gateway we reversed into was still there the next day. That hadn't disappeared. That was still there. But it was almost like for a brief time we were somewhere else. Yeah, it was very odd. The high strangeness of it all. Very, very weird.
Yeah, would you suggest that then it was almost as if you were elevated to see it then, Colin, in regards to how clear a sighting you could have?
Not elevated, no. Maybe my wildest guess would be that I believe this craft is dimensional. It's coming from another dimension. Possibly when it was arriving, possibly it was arriving at the time from another dimension and we got caught up in it slightly.
Mm.
Or, I don't know, yeah. Because we've got projections, haven't we? We've got telepathy involved with this. Maybe somehow they just made all the trees and all the scenery disappear so we could see it. I don't know how it happened, but it certainly happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strange, that bit. Yeah, we don't know how we could have seen it from the corner.
Once again plays into the fact that it clearly wanted you to see it.
Yes. Oh, wow, yes, absolutely, 100%. I mean, it was immediate from when we turned the corner. There it was. Yeah, it's very strange. Now, why didn't my brother-in-law see it? Because he couldn't have been far behind us. Even if he'd have passed us when we was in the gateway, then he surely should have seen it on the approach because we weren't in the gateway very long. And up until the gateway point, the craft was there. So part of that makes you wonder if the scenery changed and the dimension changed, did he pass us without realizing he passed us, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like I say.
Well,
this is a science we don't understand.
Well, it could be something as strange as if you were moved into wherever that had come from, that's why your brother-in-law didn't see you, because he just drove straight past, but you weren't there.
That's right, yeah. We was in another dimension briefly, the one that was surrounding the UFO as it was breaking through from one area to another.
Deary me.
Yeah, it's a possibility. We just don't know.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously the book's been out for a few weeks now, Colin. As with anything, when I've spoken to people who've had experiences or strange sightings, as we've said earlier on, when you did the reports and the articles for your local newspaper and people came forwards and reached out to you to share their experiences that sometimes they get bottled up for decades. Have you had more people reaching out to you? I think when you've had an experience like this and you've seen something strange, I don't think anything surprises you anymore, unless, as you mentioned earlier, the lady that saw it tip up and she saw the occupants. Are you now getting a new batch of people coming forwards with sharing their sightings of these triangles? Because this is the distinct thing here, that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people around the world that have seen strange things in the sky. It's the triangle aspect of this that sort of makes it a bit more unique in that I think people, unless you dive into the subject or you read a lot about UFOs, you would suspect that not that many people see these triangles. But as we both know, Colin, that's clearly not the case.
That's right. There's loads of people have seen them. Like, I've only scratched the surface of the UK and I've got 130 different sightings. And yes, lots of people are still getting in contact now. People want to talk to me. And on Facebook, I get friends requests. There's loads, like 30 or 40 a day. All of these people, they're all involved with the UFO world. They all know. So I'm nearly up to 5,000 people already on my Facebook friendship. And every one of them has had some sort of an experience. But people are contacting me on Messenger to talk about what's going on. Now, the exciting thing for me is, like I say, for the first 20 years, I talked about the nuts and bolts, but then I've later talked about the telepathy and the paranormal stuff that's going on. When people were writing into me with their experiences, I was asking them have they had any paranormal experiences.
Mm.
And more people were saying yes than no. So in the end, I put a whole chapter in the book which relates to people who have had UFO experiences as well as paranormal experiences. But it seems to be becoming more mainstream now that people are saying this. It's not just a case of it being a nuts and bolts craft coming from another planet. That doesn't seem to be the case. There's more and more people are saying that it's dimensional and they're getting other weird paranormal effects as well. In fact, I watched a program on Blaze the other night, a newish documentary about UFOs, and on there they were saying that a lot of people who have close encounters go on to have these other effects, and they call it the hitchhiker effect.
Yes.
Which I'd never heard of before.
Yep.
But now I've seen that, and some of the top researchers are saying these are dimensional. It's starting to fit in with what I've been saying and what's in the book as well. What I've put in the book about the fact that I think these are dimensional craft rather than extraterrestrial. And I think for me, it's got to be, because if that craft had come from another planet, 1,000 light years away, and we'd seen it that night and it had gone away again, you would not expect to have any other experiences afterwards. But I've had a lot of experiences afterwards, not before. So I know it's come from the UFO. And now I've got all these people writing in and saying they've had all these other experiences as well as UFO experiences. It just confirms it for me. And now the top researchers are saying the same again.
Hmm.
That these things, they believe in these things now are dimensional rather than extraterrestrial.
Yeah, yeah. It is strange. I mean, it's one of those things that you would suggest, as you mentioned there. I think I watched the same program, Colin, as well. I mean, it's something I've heard of before that, you know, some people would suggest that once you've had an encounter like that, you suddenly become more open to the world around you and realize that perhaps things are not what you thought they were, and therefore you're more susceptible to paying attention to things that would normally get overlooked.
Yes, that's right. But I think that's also partly because of the telepathy, alleged, I've got my fingers here, telepathy that took place that night.
Mm.
Because there were three other occupants in the car with me who was as close to the craft as I was, but they didn't go on to have any other experiences whatsoever. It was just me.
Yeah.
So the only thing I can figure that made that occur would be the close viewing, like the telepathy. So, yes, I think they do open up your mind to all these other things, but it may not just be a case of being next to one, because we've got a case here with four people next to one and only myself has gone on to have the extra stuff.
Yeah.
So maybe they pick on certain people.
Hmm.
I did read once somewhere that they pick on people who are telepathic because it's easier for them to communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always stuck in the back of my mind, actually, that maybe that's why they picked on me that night.
Mm. Yeah, very much so. It's interesting, and it's a real shame, as you refer to, that you know, two people who I've always wanted to have the opportunity to speak to and can never do so, unfortunately, it's both Dr. John Mack and Bud Hopkins. Obviously, I've got to know Peter Robbins over the last few years, who was one of Bud's best friends and someone that worked alongside him a lot. And it would be interesting to see how they view things and how our conversations have changed in the last 15, 20 years, Colin, from what it was when they were doing their work before they both sadly passed in very different circumstances to where we are now, and the fact that people are having a more mature and nuanced conversation. You know, as you touch on in the book, we seem to have got away from the derision and abuse that people would usually get when they come forward with these things. And obviously the climate that we've got now, you know, we've got major governments around the world that are treating this subject far more seriously than they ever have. And long may that continue. And obviously, as we speak, we are on the cusp of a congressional hearing in the US that may or may not push the envelope even further down the line from where we thought we were 4 or 5 years ago. So who knows what's next in store for us?
Yeah, I think it's probably a natural progression for the human race.
Mm.
Because people, like you say, now are taking on board the fact that these things are more likely to be dimensional, and it's tied in with your own psyche, if you like.
Yeah.
Your own spiritual awareness. So maybe we are all becoming more spiritual beings, because certainly the reporting from, you know, what I've been talking about today, if I said like 100 years ago or 200 years ago, I'll probably get burnt at the stake. But these days, people are accepting it, which is great. And I think that's what's happening. There's a bit of an awakening. And certainly as the government's come out with more and more, hopefully if they do, more and more people will become aware and involved. But it's going to be a bit difficult, isn't it? Because people are going to think initially it's just nuts and bolts coming from another planet, but it's not. It's far more complex than that. And I don't know how vast majority of people are going to take it on board. So maybe it is a case of slowly educating everybody to what's taking place. So maybe that's what my book's all about, and the models that.
Yeah.
It's not a major thing. It's not like a smoking gun, because, you know, we haven't got any films of it on television, but it is getting out there. It is being seen by people. And I have made people aware in the book that this is tied in with paranormal. I have to say, I was a little bit concerned when I wrote the book that some of my friends reading it, and certainly some of my family, my brothers and that, who don't know all of what took place, would probably end up thinking I'm a bit crazy. But so far... So far, so good. Nobody's come out and said that.
Yeah.
Quite the opposite, in fact. In the little village you live in now, Barwell, you know, people call me the UFO man. It's quite encouraging to go around and chat with people. Everybody's got a story to tell. It's really amazing.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Colin, it's been a real pleasure.
Yes, it's been great.
The book's a great collection. Like I say, anybody that's got an interest in ufology or high strangeness or the niche aspect of triangle sightings would be highly recommended to get hold of a copy. So where can everybody find the book, follow your work, and hopefully not swamp your friend requests on Facebook, or if they've even got an experience or a sighting with a triangle that you're not aware of, how can they get in touch with you, sir?
I think the easiest way would be to get in touch via Messenger on Facebook with any sightings that you want to chat about, and then I can email you back. And we can talk that way. The book itself is available on Amazon. It's a paperback, hardback. There's a Kindle version. There's also an audio version as well available. So Amazon is the place to go and look for the book. And it's Triangular UFOs of the United Kingdom by Colin Saunders. And for anybody who's interested, I mean, when I had my experience, I would have loved to have got hold of a book like this. I would have just read it from start to finish and read it again and again and again. It would have calmed me down, to be honest. I was quite hyper in the early days. So I'm hoping that some people out there, if you've had an experience, buy the book, have a read of all the other experiences, and you'll know you're not alone with the subject.
Fabulous. Colin, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for your time, your conversation, and your kindness.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Thanks for having me on.